I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There's no question that Pennsylvania's roads and bridges, even public transit systems, are in need of upgrade and repair. That was the conclusion of the American Society of Civil Engineers in their most recent report, which gave the state a C-. The Senate voted in June to provide several billion in funds to fix that infrastructure by increasing a gas tax, registration fees, and fines for things like speeding. The House voted against the bill on Monday, which included a change to the state's prevailing wage laws. Then yesterday, the House approved the bill in a dramatic about-face. It now goes back to the Senate and, if passed, back to the House and, if passed, to Governor Corbett for his signature. We asked John Micek to tell us what happened in the House, and he is editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and for Penn Live. And John Micek, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Not too bad.
So what happened in the House yesterday?
This is an example of good old-fashioned retail politicking. As your Mary Wilson said during the news broadcast, it was a matter of eight nays becoming yays, and the way you do that is by promising people things that they want. Some of these no votes were brought on side by giving them stuff that they wanted. Seth Grove, a Republican from your county out here, got assurances on the prevailing wage language that we can talk about. Stan Saylor, the House Majority Whip, got a project in his district. Patty Kim, a Democrat from Harrisburg, got a project for her district. And everyone kind of knew that this is the way this fight was going to be won. It was going to be won literally road mile by road mile, project by project.
But did the leadership not know that this bill was going to be defeated on Monday?
The funny thing was, going in on Monday, that there seemed to be the votes, and then by late in the afternoon, some votes had begun peeling off, and they found themselves three or four Republican votes short and three or four Democratic votes short, and that was the difference.
But what's interesting is, even on Monday and also yesterday, is that the support and the opposition pretty evenly split between the Democrats and the Republicans.
That's true. I mean, you're going to have some Republicans who weren't going to vote for this no matter what, because they view it as a $2.4 billion tax increase funded through the lifting of the cap on wholesale gasoline tax and the fees that motorists pay for their licenses and registrations. And you have some Democrats who are just absolutely opposed to changing the prevailing wage laws and still are trying to hold out for more money for mass transit. So a lot of people were where they were going to be. It was just a matter of getting those who were kind of on the fence on side. And that was the end product of 2 days of pretty extreme arm twisting from Barry Shoke and the House leaders.
Is this called compromise?
You can call it that. I think it was. But, I mean, in the end, this is something that Governor Corbett wanted pretty badly. And in Barry Shoke, he actually has a very effective ambassador. I've watched the guy for, 10 or 11 months now, prowling the hallways of the Capitol trying to line up votes for this thing. He's been absolutely tireless.
And he's the transportation secretary here in Pennsylvania.
That's correct.
I'm curious, and Governor Corbett has been very clear about his support of this, but how does he reconcile that with his no taxes pledge?
that's an excellent question. I mean, I guess there's an argument to be made, and some hardcore conservatives have made this, that when it boils down, roads and bridges are a core function of state government. They are an economic driver because they bring goods to market, and bad roads mean increased costs, and that means increased costs for consumers. And they're a public safety issue as well. Weight-restricted bridges means it takes longer for ambulances and emergency service vehicles to get to emergency scenes. Secretary Shoke has said more than once that school buses carrying school kids will have to be rerouted, taking it longer for them to get to school in the morning. So that has really been the argument that Governor Corbett has made for this. And, St. Rover of low taxes in Washington has not agreed with his stance, but thankfully he's broken with that. And that's Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform. The no tax pledge.
Which Corbett did pledge to uphold. Interestingly, though, Daryl Metcalf has called this the Corbett tax.
That's Representative Metcalf for you, who's never met a tax like he didn't hate viscerally. But this is something the governor. This is a political win that the governor needed going into a very tough reelection cycle. It's already become a campaign issue. Congresswoman Allison Schwartz, who sort of widely looked at as the Democratic front runner in 2014, was in the Capitol last week, hawking her own transportation plan and trying to lean on House Democrats to vote for it. So this is something that Governor Corbett needed both as a policy victory and as a political victory.
And I noticed that earlier on, perhaps it was even on Monday, that Corbett brought in former Governor Ed Randell. And Ed Randell has been very outspoken in his support of fixing Pennsylvania's ailing infrastructure.
That's correct. Former Governor Randell, along with Mayor Mike Bloomberg of New York City and former Arizona Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, have been part of this triumvirate lobbying group for the last couple of years, whose name escapes me at the moment, but they've been pushing for greater infrastructure both at the state and federal level, making sort of the same arguments that Governor Corbett has, that there are economic drivers and a matter of public safety. And there's really, you know, Governor Randell's words still carries a lot of weight with legislative Democrats. So to bring him in to lean on Democrats on Monday was a fairly smart move.
Now it goes to the Senate. Is that today, John?
We are told that a Senate vote is expected as early as today. Today, in fact, is the last scheduled session day before a Thanksgiving break. So, yes, they do need to get this over the goal line. It's amazing how quickly things move in Harrisburg when all the tumblers fall into place. And the governor, if things go to plan, will be signing the bill as early as tomorrow.
Wow. And we're talking about raising taxes. There's a fuel tax involved in this. Can you break down, I guess, the tax part of it? And then I do want to talk to you about the prevailing wage part of it.
Sure. What this does is lift the cap on Pennsylvania's wholesale gasoline tax. That's a tax that's paid by gas stations, and the cap hasn't. It's an inflationary adjustment. The exact figure eludes me at the moment. But the argument from critics was that invariably such an increase would be passed along at the pump. But advocates have said, you know, you see such wild fluctuations in gas prices from week to week anyway. That the very negligible increase that this would result in would be barely noticed at the pump. So that's been the prime funding mechanism all along. And you've had tax hawks in the state house, like Steve Bloom, a Republican out of Cumberland County, who's just dead set against this. But when it gets down to cases, there's really no other predictable funding source. Mm-hmm. The bill declared the Senate back in June was predicated on this tax hike. It's a decent chunk of money. It's a little bit more than $1 billion, about $1.8 billion, I think.
And we're also talking about increased fees and fines as well.
That's right. The fee for licenses and registrations would go up from 1 year to 2 years, and from 4 years to, I believe, 6 years for motor vehicle licenses. And there would be a surcharge on moving violations, raising about $250 million that would be funneled into mass transit programs.
So catching speeders and making them pay more for their fines.
So that's right. So before you think about going 75 in that 40 zone, give it a good think.
Indeed. Let me ask you about the prevailing wage part, because this I think gets pretty interesting and also shows some divisions, I guess, within the Democratic Party, but certainly between Democrats and Republicans, having to do with the wages for these construction projects. Help us understand what the House voted on yesterday.
That's right. Pennsylvania's prevailing wage law requires that union-scale wages be paid on most public construction projects. The law has been on the books since 1963 and hasn't been tweaked in the intervening 50 years. The language that was before lawmakers last night raised the threshold at which this wage requirement kicked in. It's at only $25,000 right now, and that would be raised. The threshold would be raised to any project in excess of $100,000. Advocates for this argue that because these wage requirements drive up costs, it would reduce the number of projects that could be funded. So if you raise the threshold, you therefore increase the number of projects that can be funded. This is something that Republicans in the House have sought for a long time. House Speaker Sam Smith had made that conditional for his support for the bill. Obviously, if you're a pro-union Democrat, you don't like this because your fear is that it's going to drive wages down across the sector. But a couple of major unions had actually signed on in support of this. So when that happened, it kind of made it inevitable that it was going to go across. Now we'll just have to see what happens to it in the Senate, but I think there's enough Republican support there that it should go through.
And I was reading that most of the representatives from the Philadelphia area in the House voted in support of this bill.
Your knowledge would be better than mine, but that makes a lot of sense. John Taylor, the ranking Democrat on the Labor Committee, has been in favor. Sorry, was opposed to this, but it's not surprising to see them go on side in the end, because really what it comes down to is that they need this bill.
And for Governor Corbett, as you wrote, John, this and the pension issue are two important, I guess, issues before the legislature, and obviously before the governor as well.
That's correct. I mean, I've written at, outside of pensions, they face no more pressing a public policy challenge, I think, than transportation funding. To me, it goes to not only sort of the very practical economic things of it, but the way we view ourselves as a state and as a culture and things that we can get done. Barry Shoke was out there on Monday night after this almost identical language went down defeat in the House, saying that he hopes Pennsylvania can show itself to be less dysfunctional than Washington.
Ouch.
He said that was proved not to be the case. Apparently, never doubt the power of public shame, because there are some lawmakers who did not want to be lumped in with Congress no matter what, and that moved some of them off the dime as well. But I mean, it is about our image as a state and a culture and what we can get done. The stuff that we build, I think, reflects our priorities, and I have to believe that was in the minds of a lot of lawmakers as well.
And do you think, John, the fact that they, at least so far, looks like the transportation bill is going to move forward, do you think that bodes well for pension reform, or is that a whole other kettle of fish?
That's just entirely different. I mean, the numbers there are so complex, the amount of money is so massive, the knots that have to be unraveled are legion. I would be shocked to see anything happen this year. That said, when they come back after Thanksgiving, all sorts of funny stuff can happen. But I don't think anyone thinks that's going to be accomplished this year.
And how many days left in session for the rest of this year?
If I can do my math correctly, they had 10 session days for the whole of the year. So they've been through what, 3 of them as of today. So that would leave them 7 session days before they go home for Christmas.
Are you a betting man, John Micek?
I have never to underestimate the capacity of the legislature not to get things done.
So you're, I mean, and until, I guess, Corbett's signature is on this bill, you're not going to...
For the, are we talking about transportation? I think this one, if we're talking pension funding, forget it. For this one, I think this one's going to get over the goal line.
Well, John, as always, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's John Micek, the first of 3 guests in this hour of Radio Times, editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and Penn Live. We are talking about the fact that the House surprised a lot of people yesterday, voting in support of a transportation bill. It goes back to the Senate, back to the House, and then probably to Governor Corbett for his signature. We're going to be talking about what it means when a bridge is called structurally deficient or functionally obsolete, or a road in poor or mediocre condition. That's coming up next here on Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Delaware's resident ensemble players supports WHYY and presents the Italian comedy The Servant of Two Masters, now through December 8th. Hilarity abounds in this boisterous romp of lovers, lawyers, servants, and flying plates of meatballs. When the trickster Truffaldino hatches a zany scheme to both double his wages and his meals, the wisecracks soar and slapstick takes center stage. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
This week in This American Life, in 7th grade, Domingo and his mom and dad were all on the highway near the U.S.-Mexican border in separate cars doing something they had never done before, and it was not going well.
Oh God, my mother says. I had never heard her voice so charged with fear. She grabs the knob that controls the headlights and flashes at Dad.
Smuggling marijuana with your parents this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, the women who worked in the Kennedy White House, their jobs important yet little recognized.
Jobs couldn't have been done without us. I think many of our so-called bosses understood that. I don't know that any of them particularly admitted it out loud.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. And as John Misek just told us, a transportation bill is making its way through the Pennsylvania legislature, and it could mean billions in road projects, bridges as well, and for mass transit. Joining us now are Peter Swan, Associate Professor of Logistics and Operations Management at Penn State Harrisburg. And Peter Swan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
Also with us is Franklin Moon, and he's Associate Professor in the Department of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering at Drexel University, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Frank Moon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Peter, since you're in there, you're in Harrisburg, and I'd just be curious. I know you were listening to John Misek, and you've been following this whole infrastructure issue here in Pennsylvania. Do you feel heartened by what's happening in the legislature?
Heartened it doesn't fully describe how I feel about this. I was kind of preparing for this and wondering how deep I should get in the details and how bad the situation is, and now it looks like it'll be resolved.
Well, interestingly, I had written a whole different introduction and list of questions for John Misek, had to change them all around this morning. But you see this, Peter, as a good thing for Pennsylvania?
Well, absolutely. We are looking at bridges continuing to deteriorate over the next 10 years. We're looking at a terrible deterioration in transit in Philadelphia, and I would assume Pittsburgh as well. Trucks that are going to cost more to deliver freight. People are going to take longer to get to work. I don't see, you know, how that's anything but very bad.
Very bad. And I want to pick up on that. But, Frank, I want to get you in on the conversation. You come this slightly differently in that you're an engineer. You're not immersed in the world of politics. But from your perspective, assuming this bill gets passed by Corbett and it releases more than $2 billion for projects, do you see that as a good thing for Pennsylvania?
Yes. It's absolutely a very positive step. If you look at Pennsylvania's the state of their bridges, they're actually very poor compared to the national average. They're much older, average age of 54 years old. They have the largest number of structurally deficient bridges. And the reality is that the cost of bringing these bridges into a state of good repair keeps going up every year. Right. So if you continue to kick this can down the road, you're going to eventually have to deal with the situation. It's just going to be more expensive.
And I wonder to you, Peter, I mean, we don't want to get ahead of the news here, but in terms of priority, and we're talking about, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, 57% of Pennsylvania's roads are in poor or mediocre condition. I think anyone that's driven on the roads in the state can attest to that. How do you suggest prioritizing what happens first?
Well, I think that might be a better question for an engineer, because it's both a question of safety and which are in dire need. We're having bridges that they're starting to put weight limits on and close because they're no longer safe for traffic. Obviously, those have to be done first. But the other question is, and again, I think engineering really has the answer here, which ones are going to cost you more money if you don't do something right away?
Would you agree, though, Frank, that if we're talking about bridges, and again going back to the American Society of Civil Engineers saying that 24.4% of the bridges in Pennsylvania are structurally deficient and 19.3% are considered functionally obsolete, are bridges the first priority?
I think they should be a major priority. I mean, but what you're talking about there is a huge haystack of bridges, right? Something that's not going to be addressed wholesale. And so one of the keys is to prioritize so that the most important bridges and the ones that actually offer the most significant risk to the public are addressed first. Now, the one thing I would say about the posting is just because a bridge is posted for 10 tons or 20 tons doesn't mean it's unsafe for a 30-ton vehicle to drive across it. What it means is what PennDOT's trying to do is control the amount of truck traffic a bridge sees so that you can slow that deterioration process. So it's not that it's unsafe. It's just if we're going to have to keep these bridges and preserve them for 5-10 years as we prioritize, you want to make sure that they're in good working order during that time.
And going back to the bridges, there are, according again to the American Society of Civil Engineers, 22,669 bridges in Pennsylvania. 5,504 of them are considered structurally deficient. What does that mean, Frank?
So what it means is, technically what it means, bridges get rated on a 0 to 9 scale, and it means that it has fallen to a 4. That's the definition. Now, what that 4 means is that the bridge appears to be deteriorating, right? That you see
from the outside, it looks.
From the outside, you see corrosion of steel. You see spalling of concrete. It doesn't look. It doesn't look great. But it's not directly correlated with safety. Some of these bridges were built with 5 or 10 times the capacity that they needed to safely carry traffic. So they can undergo significant levels of deterioration before they get to a point where they're unsafe. And I think that's the big misconception. You see a bridge, it looks like it's in bad shape,
right,
and people are afraid to cross it. There's a lot of risks on the highway, but most of them are related to traffic accidents, not crossing bridges.
Well, and let me just follow up on that. And Peter, then I will get back to you because you and some Drexel students are doing some interesting work on the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge, which is here in Philadelphia, crosses the Delaware into New Jersey, putting sensors and cameras on this bridge to what? See how it's affected by traffic?
Yes, all of the above. So historically, bridges have been assessed just based on their visual appearance. It tends to be very qualitative and subjective. And what's happening now with the development of technology over the last 10 to 20 years is we have the ability to go out, put sensors, put imaging techniques on bridges, and get much better objective quantitative information, mm-hmm. understand how the bridge carries traffic, what it feels like when Hurricane Sandy comes through. The big area of research right now that I'm engaged in, and a lot of other folks are as well, is taking these techniques and trying to package them so that they can be economically applied to tens of thousands of bridges. Signature bridges, if you look at, for example, the Tappan Zee Bridge that's going in and the New Gothels Bridge and the Bayonne Bridge raising, all of them have sensing as a major component. That has become part of the practice for those bridges. We need to somehow package this technology in a way where it becomes economical for the run-of-the-mill bridges.
You used an interesting metaphor when we were talking before going on the air, saying, you know, if you don't feel well and you go to the doctor and they just give you a kind of a once-over glance and they don't do an EKG or an MRI or perhaps take your blood, then they really don't know what's going on with you. And you're saying this is how we should think about bridges.
Yeah, and I think, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be a major revolution in bridge engineering. I mean, we're a little bit behind the times. I hate to be too critical, but the way that we're assessing bridges today is very similar to the way that we were assessing bridges in the 80s and the 70s. And almost everything else has changed, has been revolutionized by information technology, by sensing, by computer simulations. And that is just beginning to find its way into, you know, traditional bridge engineering practice now.
Peter, you want to weigh in on what Frank has been doing?
I think it's great. I've been noticing that the design of bridges has been changing pretty dramatically as well, just from the outside. I also know that, you know, the reason we have functionally obsolete is many of the bridges they used to make weren't very robust if there was a failure of a critical part. New bridges are made to be robust so that there's no critical part that if it fails, the bridge will go down. I also wanted to add that starting under Rendell, Pennsylvania had put a good chunk of money into fixing bridges. And also under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, there was, about $1 billion that the federal government poured into Pennsylvania bridges. We've actually are better off today than we were a couple of years ago. And the question was, you know, where does it go from here? Because a lot of the money we had been using is going to be gone from now on.
But I guess, if this bill makes it through the legislature and to Governor Corbett, that would mean some money to be spent, Peter.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other big change, historically, the funding's been through fuel taxes. And both the federal and the Pennsylvania fuel taxes have been frozen at a certain number of cents per gallon since 2006.
Right.
And for the federal, it's 1993. And during that time, the price of maintaining and building roads has gone up dramatically, 3 times or so. the money we have just doesn't go as far. So this bill will remove the caps and let these fuel taxes rise with inflation so that we can keep pace going into the future.
And I'm assuming vehicles are getting better mileage today than they did 10 or 20 years ago, and that also affects the tax.
Absolutely, and also, you know, between the mileage and the inflation effect, we've been steadily losing ground over the past 20 years. Additionally, you have vehicles using alternative fuels, which may not pay any fuel tax at all. Somewhere down the road, the fuel tax isn't going to cut it anymore either, and we're going to move to something else.
Going after those speeders, I guess, and hitting them hard.
Or tolling. Or worse, for privacy fanatics, VMT tax, where you have to see how many miles everybody drives.
Oh, using sort of EasyPass kind of technology?
Well, that would be one way, but the problem with applying EasyPass everywhere is you'd need transponders on every road, and that gets real expensive. What they'd probably do is use some sort of GPS or satellite technique to both tell how many miles you've driven and which road you were on.
Let me quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Peter Swan. He's Associate Professor of Logistics and Operations Management at Penn State at the Harrisburg campus. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Franklin Moon, Associate Professor in the Department of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering at Drexel University. And yes, we are talking about Pennsylvania's infrastructure, its bridges, its roads, its public transit system, and the fact that the House in Harrisburg voted yesterday to approve more than several billion dollars to help fix some of this ailing infrastructure. It goes to the Senate and then back to the House and possibly to Governor Corbett for his signature. We want to know what you think of of Pennsylvania's infrastructure. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Frank, I'm curious about this work you're doing on the Tacony-Pomara Bridge here in the Philadelphia area, and whether is it too soon to tell us about how this bridge is functioning and I guess operating under traffic conditions?
No, I mean we've started putting sensors out on that bridge and actually the Burlington-Bristol Bridge and a few others as well. Those projects started about 5 years ago, so we've been collecting data all through. Effectively what we're doing is creating signatures of how the bridge operates on a daily basis. And believe it or not, the largest stresses the bridge feels is when the sun comes up in the morning and heats up certain members and they try to expand and the other
members. Certain parts of the bridge.
Right. So it sort of fights itself. I refer to it as it's kind of daily calisthenics. And you can track that and you get a feel for what a normal day is like. And then when you have events like the earthquake that occurred in Virginia or the hurricanes that have come through, we can see how those affected that. And in fact, none of them did. The bridge is incredibly robust. Wow. We were able last year to track it through Hurricane Sandy, to work with the Burlington County Bridge Commission to decide for them to implement their policies on when do you close it to pedestrians, when do you close it to truck traffic, et cetera, based on wind speeds. So it's been fairly successful, and I think the Bridge Commission and their engineer of record have really started to incorporate this sensing system within their kind of daily management and decision-making practices.
And how old is this particular bridge?
So the bridge was built in, I believe it's 1929, 1930. It's a Ralph Majeski design. He's one of the greatest bridge builders in U.S. history. He also built the Ben Franklin Bridge. So it has a very good pedigree.
Now, we know in Pennsylvania there are bridges that are 100, 200, sometimes even more, older than that. And this is, I guess, a broad question, but if a bridge is, say, 250 years old, should we worry about its safety?
Well, I mean, the good news is it's lasted 250 years, so it's got to have something going for it. It really depends on primarily on kind of the form of the bridge. If you look at these old stone arch bridges that are the ones that are typically about the 250-year-old bridges, those can last very long. There are Roman aqueducts that have a similar design that are thousands of years old. It also depends greatly on how bridges are being maintained.
Right.
Right. So part of it is kind of the internal intrinsics of the bridge design and the quality of the design and construction. And then part of it is how that bridge is maintained over its lifetime.
And Peter, let me go back to you and just pick up on the maintenance part of it, because I know that was one of the concerns, is that in Pennsylvania, we just haven't had the money to maintain our infrastructure. True?
That's absolutely right. And it got worse. I should say efforts to fix it go back to Governor Rendell with Act 44, which was supposed to get money by tolling Interstate 80, which didn't happen. And as a result, all our plans were based on the hopes of getting that money, which didn't materialize. And now there's just, till this bill passes, there's just not enough to do the job.
And of course, that's I mean, maintenance is such an important part of any kind of infrastructure, Peter.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting too. About 10 years ago, I remember PennDOT made a very important decision that they were no longer going to pursue any big projects, and that they were going to spend all of the money they had on maintaining the present system. And that was kind of a momentous time for them. They realized that there wasn't enough to do anything more. They were going to be hard-pressed to just keep what they had going. And since that 10 years ago, things have gotten worse. You know, people may not realize it, but small things have made a big difference. Schuster, when he was in D.C., yeah, Bud Schuster, brought a lot of money into Pennsylvania for road building. When he left, a lot of the other states that had kind of mad that Pennsylvania had gotten so money really took it out on us, and our allocation of federal funds took a nosedive for several years.
And those were those pesky earmarks, yes?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So, you know, I can't overestimate how important this is. I don't think it's all we need,
right. But
it's enough to at least get ahead of the problem instead of getting worse off. We're no longer going to be, you know, kicking the can till it goes over the cliff. We're at least going to be inching our way back to where we need to be. I think the other thing that's important, I was kind of upset with the current governor in that he had a report done back in August of 2011, and it's taken over 2 years to actually get this to a vote where something passes. It's been known since 2006, when one of the first reports on this came out, that these steps needed to be taken.
Mm.
But it's taken this long to gather the political will to do it. And I think one of the reasons is, you know, the no tax movement. People don't understand, you know, what they're actually paying and where that money's actually going. And I think hopefully they'll get an understanding with this bill, and hopefully they'll see improvement in their bridges and roads.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Pennsylvania's bridges, its roads, its mass transit, its infrastructure, and the fact that it looks like the Keystone State might be passing a bill sometime this week that would help to fix, repair, replace some of this aging infrastructure. Peter Swan, Associate Professor of Logistics and Operations Management at Penn State at the Harrisburg campus, and also with us, Franklin Moon, Associate Professor in the Department of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering at Drexel University. You drive our roads, you use our bridges, you probably use mass transit. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Recall the first time you met John Kennedy?
Yes, I do.
I told him, I said, Mr. Kennedy, he says, look, my name is Jack. You call me Jack.
And there he was, the President of the United States, standing on the doorstep.
I'm Robert McNeil, and the program is We Knew JFK, Unheard Stories from the Kennedy Archives, from the Public Radio Exchange.
God, I hope they don't play this for a long, long time.
Friday night at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Key and Peele, we talk with Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele about their sketch comedy show on Comedy Central. Many of their sketches deal with race and draw on their experiences being biracial. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A diamond in the rough.
We're trying to do the right thing. It's very hard. We've got top people involved inside and outside the company, and hopefully over time we will make this a much smaller issue.
J.P. Morgan chief Jamie Dimon takes another hit after a $13 billion settlement. Assessing his future, that's next time on The Takeaway.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco, and just to recap, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, Pennsylvania gets a poor grade when it comes to the condition of its state's roads and bridges. The Pennsylvania Senate passed a multi-billion dollar transportation bill earlier in the summer to fix some of these roads and bridges and also to give some money to mass transit. On Monday, the House voted against the legislation. Then yesterday, it had a change of heart and voted for the legislation, and we are talking about the state's roads and bridges and public transit with Frank Moon and Peter Swan, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We have an emailer, Gerard from Nazareth, feels that a lot of the deterioration is due to tractor trailers. Shouldn't the trucking industry pay for these repairs? Let me toss that first to you, Frank. Are the tractor trailers part of the problem here?
I think they're certainly part of the equation. You could also look at the dump trucks, the ones that are probably a more concentrated footprint but have similar weights as the tractor trailers. But the reality is we don't have a good feel for what actually causes the deterioration. And then people may find that a little strange. But if I can make an analogy to public health, where they have a lot of these epidemiology studies that are looking for what causes diseases, what makes people at high risk, there's actually a very large federal research program going on right now called the Long-Term Bridge Performance Program, and it's effectively trying to do the same for bridges. So whether it's de-icing chemicals, whether it's tractor trailers, whether it's freeze-thaw cycles or poor maintenance, et cetera, it's probably a combination of all of those, and it probably varies between, you know, bridges deteriorate in Pennsylvania very differently for different reasons, right, probably than they deteriorate in Georgia, for example.
I'm thinking about things like weather.
Sure. I mean, we're kind of in the rust belt here.
Sure, right? Sure. Pete, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I'd add that trucks pay a lot more, too. You know, if you look at the turnpike fees, a car is paying about 8 cents a mile and a truck's paying 44 cents a mile. There's also higher excise tax on truck tires and truck licensing fees. And additionally, the fuel tax they pay is higher, especially when you consider they get 6 miles to the gallon for our 20 or 30.
And Pete, you had mentioned mass transit, which if this bill goes through would include some money for mass transit. And of course, people living here in the Philadelphia area know about SEPTA, the regional rail system. I'm assuming Pittsburgh has something similar, probably on a smaller scale. Is this an issue across the state?
Well, it is. SEPTA wrote a letter to, I think, the governor and others basically saying they were going to systematically shut down parts of the mass transit network over the next 30 years if there wasn't some money available soon. So, you know, they were very, very worried. I've talked to friends who are associated with some other bus companies providing urban transportation, not Pittsburgh and Philly, and they were very worried as well and were going to take some hits. There's two sides to this. One is the money for mass transit, and the other side is, to some extent, we've been subsidizing auto travel and truck travel by not making them pay for maintenance. And now that it's going to get slightly more expensive to operate your car, mass transit looks that much better.
Well, that's interesting in the sort of configuration there. Let me go back to you, Frank, and I think we all remember that horrifying collapse in 2007 in Minneapolis, the bridge that collapsed. And that was a pretty, you know, sizable bridge, and obviously lives were lost. People were injured as a result of that. How much do you think that was a real wake-up call or just an aberration?
Well, I think certainly it was a focusing event. After that event, you started to hear people talk about bridges a lot more in, you know, political debates. I don't really get too involved in those things, but I would hear a lot more about bridges following that event. I mean, that was a very unique situation. The other, you know, primary or influential collapses like the Schoharie Bridge in New York in the late 80s or the Mianus River Bridge or the Silver Bridge, those had direct impacts on the profession. The profession, because of those events, started to do things differently in a fairly short period of time. Because I-35 was a very unique situation, we haven't seen that sort of impact on the profession, but certainly getting the attention of the citizenry that this is a growing issue as our infrastructure ages, I think it certainly played a role there.
But are we talking about bridge hysteria?
Yeah, I think so. I think people shouldn't be afraid to cross bridges, and I hear this a lot. The reality is very, very, very few bridges, get to the point of collapse in this country. So, if you're driving in your car, you should be worried about getting in a traffic accident far more than you should be worried about crossing a bridge.
Well, and I have to say, obviously, having crossed a whole bunch of bridges in my life and sort of saying to myself as I cross them, I wonder how this works. I mean, I wonder how they built this thing. What about those big, swooping cords?
The cables, right?
The cables,
so
exactly.
The suspension bridges and things. Right. Yeah, I think I would kind of group fear of crossing bridges with fear of flying. I think when you don't have a good intuition about how could something this large stand for so long and still be safe, because of that uncertainty, that sort of breeds fear. But the reality is these bridges are very safe and they're very redundant, most of them, meaning that you could, in fact, go out there and remove certain members of the bridge and you're not going to cause a collapse. These bridges, the analogy is that bridges are like belts and suspenders.
Oh,
right?
Belts, right.
So you have multiple ways to carry the load.
Let me go back to you, Pete, and then we'll get back to our callers. And talking about the Pennsylvania Turnpike, is that the oldest turnpike in the country or one of the oldest?
My understanding, it's the oldest.
Right. And I remember, we've gotten calls from truckers and drivers on the Pennsylvania Turnpike complaining about its condition. I'd just be curious, since it goes through the middle of the state from one end to the other, just how important it is to the economy of Pennsylvania.
Well, that's a real good question, and it on many levels. It's important in this, to the extent that right now it's funding part of our maintenance program through Act 44. We took out kind of a reverse loan on the Pennsylvania Turnpike a few years back, where they sold bonds and gave the money to the state to repair bridges and then raise the tolls in order to fund it.
Hmm.
But it's kind of interesting for trucks because a lot of trucks don't use the Pennsylvania Turnpike. They'll use I-80 instead to avoid the tolls.
Oh, interesting.
The ones that use it are the ones that have time-sensitive freight or expensive freight that needs to get there as quickly as possible.
And what about public-private partnerships? I know that has been used in other states to try to deal with some of this infrastructure.
Right. Well, they generally can provide maintenance at a lower cost. But you have to separate the operation of the entity, the road, if you will, from the setting of rates and the control of it. Many of the public-private infrastructure deals that have been done, in particular the Indiana Toll Road and the Chicago Skyway, were basically a means for the government to get a lot of money up front in return for the person or the entity leasing the road to raise the tolls and collect a lot of money down the road.
I would assume that a lot of local communities are responsible for the roads that go through them. It isn't the state's responsibility necessarily, but let's say a community in one of the counties around Philadelphia. Would that be true, Peter?
Yeah, absolutely. And some of this money is going to go to local communities. Some of it goes to the state roads, but there's other monies to help local communities fix their own bridges and do some road maintenance as well.
I'm curious about new bridge designs. I was actually out in San Francisco not so long ago and went over that wild and beautiful new bridge that they built over from San Francisco, I guess, over to Oakland or to Berkeley.
The Bay Bridge,
exactly. Is that sort of what bridges are going to be looking like? Are there new materials that are being used, for instance?
I think, again, I'm not sure the materials have quite found their way into practice. What you see these days for long span bridges, and it's really driven by the construction practice, is that cable state bridges are the way to go. Right. And so if you look at what Tappan Zee, the new Tappan Zee Bridge, the new Gothels Bridge, that's where you have a few towers, and then there's a series of cables that come straight diagonally from the tower to the roadway, as opposed to the older style suspension bridge. When it comes to the smaller run-of-the-mill bridges, the ones that make up most of the 600,000 bridges in the U.S., one of the big drivers now is something they call accelerated bridge construction, where what they're trying to do is replace a bridge in a weekend. And there are different programs. Effectively, what they do is they build the bridge on-site, but they don't remove the old bridge from service, and they try to do that over a very short period of time, where they remove it, they pick up the new bridge, and they drop it into place.
Wow.
And the idea is to cut down user costs. So this is a big sort of driver. They've done it, I think, Nebraska, Massachusetts. There's various states that are really pushing this.
Interesting. Let me see what looks like Suzanne from Germantown has to say. Suzanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I live in the Germantown area, and I have found that taking SEPTA is more expensive and a little bit longer than driving into the city, especially if I have a family, which is a family of only three.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder, you know, is there a way to change SEPTA so that it's less expensive? People have talked about, you know, like in New York City, there's nobody on the trains, and that's a big expense. And I imagine that would require a huge change to the infrastructure and how you actually walk on to the train. And I wondered if that would be a possibility to, you know, because it doesn't get appealing at all for me to take SEPTA.
Sure.
I would much rather drive. And, you know, and during the day, it's every hour. So I have to wait every hour if I want to take the train.
Well, and I'm not sure we can exactly answer your question, Suzanne, since there's no SEPTA representative here. And obviously, you're talking about short distances. And I would assume to you, Pete, that mass transit probably works best when people are taking longer trips or not necessarily?
Well, not necessarily. The whole point of mass transit typically is to get cars off of the highway. And one of the reasons highway funds are used for mass transit is it's often cheaper to create a mass transit line and get lots of cars off of the existing road than to expand the existing road to twice its size. I will say that so one of the times you don't need mass transit necessarily is when you have a ride pool. If you can take a car and fill it with four people or a family, it's going to be cheaper and to use that automobile. And in fact, it's nice because you're fully utilizing the roadway mm-hmm. for that vehicle. If, on the other hand, you're a single person commuting, you know, downtown to work, often, and you have to pay for parking in addition to the gasoline and the licensing of the vehicle, often you're better off using mass transit. And so the main point that it's typically been used for in inner cities is to get, you know, single occupant cars off of the road and onto the rail or bus or whatever mode gets used. For making it cheaper, it certainly could get the cost down if you got the ridership up, but in many cases there can be a chicken or the egg. If there's not enough departures, I think she was speaking to, then
every
people
hour.
Won't ride it, but it costs money to get the departures up, and you have to get them up before people will start riding, so you can run into interesting situations.
You certainly can. Kind of a circular answer to your question, Suzanne. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Anne from Pottstown has to say. Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for this program.
Sure.
I am a past president of the Philadelphia section of American Society of Civil Engineers, or ASCE, and I'm actually heading up the 2014 revision of the infrastructure report card.
Excellent.
The last time it was done was in 2010. And what I just wanted to share was that even though I'm delighted that the House passed the bill for $2.3 billion, we still have some unmet funding needs. And what I mean by that is that in 2010, there was a gap of about $3.5 billion. And by 2020, it's projected to be $7.2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So the bottom line is that the longer we wait, the more it's going to cost. and I'll take your comment off the air.
Well, I appreciate the call into Radio Times. Pete, let me toss that back to you.
Yeah, she's absolutely right. We haven't met the full need to get the system to a state of good repair. It's not going to get as bad as it was going to get because we're indexing the fuel tax to inflation. So you know, the estimates there were based on no change. But she's absolutely right. We need more money. However, we're a lot better off than we were yesterday, assuming this bill gets passed.
And to you, Frank, do you see a future where all bridges will have sensors and cameras and ways of monitoring its wear and tear and longevity?
I don't think that we're going to put fixed sensors on all bridges. I think what we're going to do is develop some tools that can go and, you know, scan a bridge and, you know, look inside the bridge deck to find out where deterioration is starting so that we can fix the problem when it's a small problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you're going to see is a lot of kind of mobile, self-contained tools that will augment the sort of visual inspection that's going on today.
And we're almost out of time here, but if someone then looks at a bridge and it just, you know, looks a little... You see rust, you see things that should be there that aren't there. Don't worry.
I would say, in general, 99.9% of the type of deterioration that you see really does not have an impact on safety. The bridge is probably very safe. Now, having said that, it was a few years ago where a bridge inspector saw a pier that was supporting I-95
yes.
that had an 8-foot crack in it that was opening. That was getting to the point where that was a real safety concern. And he did a great service by reporting it. They shut down I-95 for a few days while they did an emergency repair. It's sad that it got to that point. But, yeah, sometimes deterioration is important, but normally not.
Indeed. Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Frank, thank you very much.
That's my pleasure.
My pleasure.
And Peter, thank you very much as well. Peter Swan, Associate Professor of Logistics and Operations Management at Penn State at the Harrisburg campus. And with us here in our studio, Frank Moon, Associate Professor in the Department of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering at Drexel University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. You can also tweet me at Marty Moss Cohen. I am Marty Moss Cohen, and stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.